and this is actually the a subcommittee on public safety, not a subcommittee of the subcommittee on public safety. We have a quorum for one of the first times in the opening of the committee. I'm very pleased by that. I have to send you all to Oregon Youth to find the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. So let's go ahead and get started. Mr. Borden, would you like to tee things up for us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this afternoon the military department will continue with their presentation. They'll begin with budget drivers, proceed through a congressional brief, the 2% reductions in performance measures, I believe, and perhaps get into their policy packages associated with the governor's recommended budget. There's a couple notes, and perhaps General Caldwell will speak to it about the a presentation on Monday afternoon with the civilian support team.
Civil
support team, pardon me. And they have a few responses to some of the questions that were raised at yesterday's hearing.
General Caldwell.
Already got a mess going up here. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Military Department. And with me is my fiscal administrator, Carl Jorgensen. On my left, on my right, is with Satish Upadhyay from the Department of Administrative Services. Appreciate the opportunity to continue on here today. Yesterday, we had questions and some comments about the civil support team that we showed you up here on the slides. Mr. Borden had asked us if we could get the team down here. We were able to work around their schedule and get them here Monday afternoon and bring some of their equipment. And we're going to put it up out here in the front, right in front of the Capitol where the buses go. And you'll get an opportunity to go crawl through that equipment, and they can explain to you what their capabilities are. And it's got a multitude of capabilities. I won't try to tell you everything, because I know I would miss something probably fairly significant. So great opportunity. This to remind you, the team's 22 members, both Army and Air National Guardsmen, that are working full-time. They're a 24-7 operation. They spent 2.5 years in training before they were certified, so they can do these tasks, and they are a force multiplier for the first responders. So they're not first responders, but they're beck and call, and they're quite mobile. So that'll be on Monday. Also, we brought some information that was brought up yesterday about National Guard Youth Challenge. I stand corrected from my able assistance here. It wasn't $14,500 per child. Actually, it ends up being somewhere around $11,000, I think, right? So it's $12,000. So provided that information to you. Also, we provided information to you, a little bit of background on the question about to add a second program. And I know there's a bill in Representative Barker's committee that he and his colleagues pushed out today to go to education, I believe it was, and then on to Ways and Means, I believe, is how it's going to go. And it would say that we would double the program. And this is a quick sheet on some of those issues that would be involved in that. You're welcome to read that and ask any questions. We also talked about yesterday in Youth Challenge about the longitudinal study we did or had done through a grant, and here's some of the highlights of that study. Provided them for you. Again, my numbers were wrong. I said 82%, and I think you can, depending on how you read it, it's either 78 or 83, depending on which topic you want to use, but it's pretty high, and I think the numbers will speak for themselves. And the last item I'll bring comment to was a question from Representative Nathanson about, you know, where the kids come from, and this is a breakdown since 04 of where our students come from, and following that are the high schools that contributed those out of those counties. So it's county by county on the front page, then the high school by high school. So certainly any questions you have on that, we'll be happy to answer those. I think we're ready to start off with chart 29, right? Slide 29. Over the past 5 years and today, as we've explained, that the Oregon National Guard has been involved in a multitude of different missions, Homeland Security, both here in the Continental United States, and also we've been deployed to Afghanistan, Iraq, Southwest Asia, just about any place in the globe where the United States has a presence, we've been there. Soldiers and airmen and families require sustaining resources to assist with reintegration back into the family and the community when they're deployed for up to 18 months. And since September 11th, we've deployed 7,350 soldiers and airmen to federal active duty. We have deployment scheduled this summer for approximately 250 soldiers. And I would just remind you that our total strength, both Army and Air, is roughly around 8,500 people. So if you look at the 7,350, 8,500, and I saw a report today that shows that 50% of the people that have deployed have since gotten out. They're no longer in the force, and so we've had to re-recruit those numbers. So that was roughly 3,500 that we've had to recruit since the same time frame. Now, 50% doesn't sound good, but on a national average, we're one of the top third states that are doing in recruiting and retention. So we actually feel pretty good about that number. Benefits and incentives associated with service in the National Guard are not simplified nor standardized across the board with the federal government. The Oregon legislature has codified enhancements for service relating to property taxes, income taxes, education benefits, emergency relief assistance, which has played a huge part in the returning veteran, and reimbursement for resident hunting and angling licenses, which we talked about earlier today as well. And for this, we are extremely grateful that the legislature chose to do this. Most of this was done in 2005, and we're very appreciative. There are several bills that we talked about that are before this body that will be coming up during this period. You can see on the chart that tuition waivers, hunting and fishing, emergency financial assistance, which I might say that Monday wasn't this committee, it was Natural Resources Subcommittee, reviewed a supplemental budget we submitted, and we asked for money to be moved out of the hunting and fishing license category in this particular number and put into the financial assistance category because we had depleted the $500,000 in the financial assistance. Whereas in the hunting and fishing, which we misestimated last year, we spent $65,000 of that, so there was some other resources there. So we asked, and it was approved by the subcommittee, and will be going on to full committee. I know you read a lot about the next subject, which is equipment shortages, and we have identified 342 types of military equipment that all states the National Guard Bureau has should have effective in response to natural disasters and consequence managements. Oregon has authorized 231 of these 342 types. We currently have shortages in 145 of these categories. For example, we're required to have 715 trucks of various sizes and types. We have 540. 50% of those trucks on hand are substitutes for the type required. And as an example, a 2.5-ton truck that we typically, we would be authorized a 5-ton truck, and there are no 5-ton trucks available in that model, so we've been able to pick up older, less effective 2.5-ton trucks and replace them, and that's termed as in lieu of. So from a practical standpoint, we have trucks, as we pointed out here, not as many as we should have. We have 540 of them. We've distributed them out so soldiers can train on them. We recognize that in response capability for the governor and the state if we are called. And we would have to, we think in those processes, we would have to marshal our forces differently and probably longer lead time, which there could be a cost to the state on state active duty issue because we'll probably put people on sooner than we normally would have in typical times. But since we have a shortage of equipment, we have to work around those. We report these key performance measures every quarter to the National Guard Bureau. In the big scheme and the total scheme of things, we're roughly 40% of our equipment that we should have, we have available. This global war on terror has caused us to deploy our best equipment with our soldiers, most of which did not return from the war zone. Congress has taken steps to fix this problem, but it's going to take a long time for these items to get out of the production stage and get back to us. Currently, when we deploy a unit, every state is required to send whatever that unit may need, depending on what the state has internally. I'll give you an example. Before we deployed our unit out of Eastern Oregon, we had a full complement of machine guns for that unit. It's called an M240 machine gun, 7.62 machine gun. The reason we had a full complement was because they're an M1 tank operation. Each tank was authorized 3 of these machine guns, 2 on the tank, 1 in spare. So we had 54 tanks, do the math, got 150 machine guns. Well, before we could get them deployed and they needed a certain number of these machine guns, we had been required to send about half of those machine guns off to another unit that was deploying to Iraq before them. And so when our people deployed, they had about 75-80%. And then, of course, what happens is another state gets tasked. At one point, we were supposed to have over 2,000 M4 machine guns in this state. We had four. To give you an idea of how desperate things got, we're in better shape now. We've got probably around 500 of those machine guns now that they've been coming in after their production. But getting them produced and getting them to our soldiers has been been very problematic.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Yes, sir.
And what does that mean in the everyday operation of your outfit here? I mean, if you've only got 500 machine guns.
Mr. Chairman, what it means is that when we bring soldiers in, we recruit people, we tell them that you're going to be do a certain activity, you're going to do a certain job, and we're going to train you to do that, that we send them off to the Army school, which they all go to, the same school as the active duty people. They come home, they've been trained to use a 240 machine gun, an M4 machine gun. They get home and they said, well, where's my machine gun? Say, well, we got two in the Army. You can share them. Certainly, from a training standpoint, it's a real morale killer. From a practical standpoint, as far as the state's concerned, with respect to whether or not we're ever going to need machine guns in this state, I thoroughly doubt that there will be an issue. It would be my experience. After 37 years, I don't ever see that happening in this state. But I think you take the same, take another example as a truck. And a soldier's trained to drive the most modernized, you know, Oshkosh truck that the Army's purchasing, or Freightliner, which has got all kinds of different applications to it that require a little bit of skill to do. They're trained at, they get through their advanced individual training, they come home and we say, oh yeah, well now we've got an M37 or an M35A2, which is a Vietnam era truck. And again, can we haul things in a truck? You bet. Is it the same thing? No. Is it good for morale? No, it's not. What we tried to do is take that equipment and we're trying to hang on to whatever we can to keep at least a few of those items in, so we'll have those pieces of equipment there. So yeah, we may have to use that truck to haul stuff day to day, and we may have to use it for an emergency, that old Vietnam era truck, but we want enough of that equipment scattered around the state so these soldiers can at least keep their skills up. And that's pretty much across the board.
So it's also a big training issue as well.
Huge training issue.
Thank you. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we've heard about the weapons shortages and trucks, and often having to use trucks that are older, not modern, inferior to what we could do if we still had what we used to have. Where do the equipment shortages leave us with regard to work that you need to do at home here in Oregon? We talk about wildland fires. We talk about other sorts of events where we call on you and you need to help us here. Are there shortages in areas where you're unable to deliver here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, I do not think that we have a situation that is so desperate that unless we had literally just calamity upon top of calamity, that we wouldn't be able to do the mission that we consider important, which is basically the governor's mission to take care of people and property and help people during a disaster. As I tried to indicate earlier, what we plan now, unlike what we perhaps used to plan, is that we recognize, you know, we see things starting to shape up. We're in constant communication with through the Office of Emergency Management and the Forestry Department, for instance, to try to get as much lead time as we can, that we can start implementing people to start moving equipment. For instance, if you have a big fire in La Grande and they've got 40% of what they should have for trucks or 30%, and we start moving things from the west side over there and pre-staging them, there's an additional cost to that. I mean, one, your full-time people aren't doing what they're paid to be doing. Two, you're probably going to bring people on, put them on state active duty. And in a normal, back in the old days, let's say, you know, before 911, if you will, we wouldn't have done that. We knew that unit had a full complement of trucks, and we would wait and see what their tasking was, and then maybe augment it with one or two pieces, half a dozen. But right now, we don't have that ability. We just don't have those kind of resources out there. So we have to think ahead now, and we got to do things in lead time. The other good news story is that, and this is a good news story for us too, because the Army Guard's done pretty much most of the heavy lifting in the state of Oregon with respect to these kinds of issues. The Air Guard has maybe, you know, part of it's because, you know, they sleep in sheets, so, you know, you don't want to get them out of those, and we have always been generous to them, so we've tasked the Air Guard a hell lot more heavier than we have in the past, and their equipment's pretty much there right at about 95% of their equipment. Now, they're not as large, nor do they have as many of those big vehicles, so we've done some things there that weren't traditional as well. So, again, I don't think there's anything that could happen in this state that we couldn't respond to. And if we saw that, I can assure you that we would be calling the state of Washington, state of Idaho, where we have agreements through the Emergency Management Compact that this body passed, I think, in 2003. Not unlike what we did with Louisiana, where Louisiana called and said, we can't get there from here, and we sent 2,100 people. So that's how, if I was in your shoes, I would think of it in those terms. And hopefully we'll be smart enough and get enough good intelligence data to know what our situation is so we're not caught short.
Please continue.
Okay. Facilities. Many factors influence the ability of our forces to meet today's demands. Infrastructure and facilities are important, and it is in our state-federal relationship, it's the primary responsibility of the governor to command our force while in a peacetime or training status. It's also the state's responsibility to provide the administration and the housing of the National Guard. Our facilities are of primary importance to us and provide the base for which all these soldiers learn their craft and sustain those skills. To accomplish this, we have 40 armories, 2 air bases, 4 training camps, and the youth challenge site. We're the third largest agency in square footage in state government. For the past decade and a half, we have struggled to maintain our facilities. They're aging, and we have not been able to meet the readiness standards set forth by the National Guard Bureau. The slide that you see on the wall right now is a depiction of the National Guard Bureau's status that we evaluate all of our facilities on and rate them based on that status. Our facilities reflect our changing mission, and we need to ensure that you as decision makers understand the value and the importance of these infrastructures, both from a homeland security standpoint and a disaster standpoint, as well as a training standpoint that we have to deal with. The deferred maintenance, the constraints on funding over the last decade and a half, have caused our facilities' deferred maintenance to rise. And I think you can see that. And I think, in fairness to that slide, that's not all. Part of that is the previous slide, because we were able to learn how to evaluate our facilities better based on the standards that Guard Bureau put out. And once you do that, you start picking that thing apart, then you see that increase based on those standards. Our mechanical systems are growing older. They're more costly to operate. Most of our facilities were built post-World War II. So if you look at the last decade, and you look at the short budgets, lack of maintenance personnel that we've had to withstand, these things, they wear out. That's just all I can tell you. Our criteria for determining deferred maintenance has also improved, like I said. So as we look at all of the things that are required, things like environmental protection and Americans with Disabilities Act, those sort of things, when you see that red code, that very well may be that code and causing that facility to be in that code. I will tell you that all of our buildings are structurally, well, all exception of one, I can attest to, are structurally sound. We have in our budget a proposed that is to enhance 4 of these armories that we recognize. If we look at our list, the previous list, you'll see that we have most of the ones that are in the yellow and the green clearly meet our standards, are going to be there for quite a little bit. If you get down to the bottom and you look at the ones that are in the black, there's several of those and that we just simply don't have a plan for. We don't see them on the long-range federal plan. We don't see them being able to get federal funding to replace them at any time soon. So those are the 4 that we've actually put in this policy option package. I knew I'd come to it. So you'll see that later in the budget.
Before you move on, could you help us understand the color coding there a little bit more and what this?
Well, obviously green means it's good to go. Everything's okay. Those are usually new facilities. If you look at, go down to Forest Grove, every one of those armories from Forest Grove above have been rebuilt or brand new since about 1989, 1990. You drop down to right below Forest Grove, you see Albany, for instance. Albany vacillates back and forth, but Albany was one of the armories that we rebuilt, we refurbished it in the late 90s under the, we used the prison program. And we spent some money on that to refurbish it. The red code could be required inadequate, and I'll use Grants Pass is probably a good example. Grants Pass has a unit in it now that didn't used to be there. I mean, it was a different kind of a unit. So their storage requirements changed. It's a different, they don't have the resource, they don't have the square footage. So we got to make accommodations for that, and it shows up on this report as being red. It's structurally sound. It's got a good heating plant. It does have some issues with a sewer because it's on a septic system. So probably the sewer and the size is what put it in the red. Lake Oswego, it's in the red. It's, again, it's a 50-year-old building. It's sound. It's got a good heat plant. It's got the kind of things that we'd expect in any public facility, but it is too small. We've got, for the units that are there, simply isn't enough space, and probably because of the age that it was built, probably 1951, 52, 53, which I don't think is old, frankly. I think 51's not a bad year, but some would argue that that is old. So that's probably what caused those to go into that area.
Okay. How many questions we got here? Representative Hanna.
Just one. Thank you, Chair Shields. General, the like in the 2004 column, the MSN and
right.
QAL in the 204 and 05, explain that.
What the MSN is, the mission. Is it mission capable? And what is the quality of it? The two ratings. And so, as I explained, like at Grants Pass, it's not mission capable because it doesn't have enough storage space for the equipment that the unit is authorized to have there. By standard unit, it would require X amount of 1,000 square feet of unheated storage and X amount of square feet of heated storage, and the building doesn't have it. It was built with a 1960s mindset, late 50s.
Can I follow up?
Yes, please.
And I'm going to ask about Roseburg because that's one of the ones I've been in. So explain Roseburg a little bit. From 01 to 03, it was adequate, and then it became inadequate, and it may not be the structural soundness of the building, but its capability to do what is required based on the number of folks there and that kind of thing?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, I would again, without having Roseburg right in front of me, I'm going to make a guess, but Roseburg is built late 40s, early 50s. It's what we call the K-style armory, which you find that same armory in Baker, you'll find it in the Dalles, you'll find it, it's the same one-size-fit-all that the Army had back after post-World War II. The unit that's in Roseburg right now at one point was one kind of a unit, now it's been changed. It's modified somewhat, not a lot, but somewhat. Based on its age when it was built, based on the unit that's there now, it probably went from yellow to red because of those two issues. Now, again, without having the exact report in front of me, which I can get, it may have an old heating system. I don't know that. It may have a roof issue, but again, I know we went through and replaced a lot of roofs through e-board actions here about the last decade or so. We've done probably 15 different roofs around the state because they just got so bad. So that, any one of those could tick it over.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
This is just a follow-up, and I know we had this conversation during the last session, but I'm going to repeat this. And this readiness report, in my opinion, is a little bit confusing because the building could be structurally sound. We could replace the roof. It might have good heat and air conditioning. I mean, it could be conditionally sound, but not conditionally ready for the current troop level assigned to that facility. So just from a pure budget standpoint, I think from my perspective, I'd rather see us look at those conditions separately rather than together. In other words, some of these are going to be deferred maintenance issues that have something to do with, you know, we're going to see pictures of the roof leaking or something else. But when it's a troop issue, or that's a different reason for a different building, not deferred maintenance. Just a point of...
No, I understand what you're saying. And I, and again, the National Guard Bureau looks at things as if you had a perfect scenario, and we don't. We recognize that. But they want to know that because they want to know what their biggest problem may be. If we can move on to the next two slides, I think it is. Yeah. This is the Dallas Armory. Dallas is the oldest armory we have in our inventory. It was built in 1911, and it's an engineering company that belongs there, and its authorized strength of 127 soldiers. Next slide. This is a list of the repairs in this particular facility, and to be candid with you, at one point we'd actually planned to close this facility and not have a unit in Dallas, and that was probably 7, 8, 9 years ago. And some of that deferred maintenance got left there for that very reason, because we thought we were going to leave there. As it turns out, we're not going to be able to do that because of the force structure changes that we've had. Go ahead to the next slide. This is what happens when you defer maintenance and you don't have people watching it. As you can see, that we've got quite a bit of dry rot up there in that facility. The picture on the left shows you the separation of the wall that's basically leaving. The wall and the ceiling are departing each other. And the roof system, we're reviewing it right now. Some of that on the right was covered. We didn't see that. It wasn't visible. And so it had a covering over it, a plaster covering. Once we pulled it off, we saw what was going on, and so we've got some severe issues there. Go ahead, next slide. This is a report that we had done by a contractor that looked at that and gave us absolute fear of God in us to get us to not cause any difficulties because of the nature of those costs. And we bring that up not because it is the oldest building. The next nearest building to that is probably 40 years earlier or 30 years advanced in that. But this is one of the facilities that we probably, if you go back and you look at our history of employees and who we had out there doing the work, we once had, which is a state requirement, is for us to take care of the facilities. When I first came here and got involved in this business 20 years ago, I went back and I looked at 20 years previous to that, we had 102 general funded employees that maintain our facilities and administer the National Guard. If you look at our chart today, and I don't know if we got one in here, but I'm sure we do someplace, we're down to 43, I believe. Most of those were taken out during the really difficult times of ballot measure 5, post-ballot measure 5, and we did not get them restored after that. They were never restored, and she'll show you that. There it is. 91 was 101, and today we're down to 42. I was wrong. I was off by one. What happens when you do that, and what we did is we regionalized our maintenance. We went in and had people coming by occasionally. We put out an edict to our people that if you want your garbage dumped, you dump it. If you want your floor swept, you sweep it. If you want your window washed, you wash it. We don't have people to do that. And you take care of yourselves. And I think we've been very efficient in doing most of that. The downside of that is they have other duties to do. And some of the important things that a normal maintenance man who's in a building every day would understand and feel and know, that didn't happen. And so this is one of those results. That's my only point in bringing that up. It's been a problem for us for a decade. Like I said, for 20 years previous to 1991, we had 100. The most we had was 102. The least we'd had was 100. And we've been declining ever since down to 42. So, and we've spread a lot of those costs over on the federal government. We've asked them to pick those things up. We've asked them to, we've basically put them on them, and we didn't have the state money to pay for it. So our military construction activities have 3 points of emphasis.
Representative,
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the square footage of that Dallas building?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm going to guess it at probably around 5,000 square feet, 6,000 square feet. It's fairly small. We've got 3 levels in it, though, so it could, when you total them up, it probably is more than that.
Follow up, please.
Sure.
I'm just looking at the repair costs, and I'm looking at a building that's built in 1911, and I'm looking at the federal government paying 75% of the cost for design and construction.
Right.
I don't know all your costs, but at $150 a square foot, if you own the property already, couldn't you build a new building for $150 a square foot? I mean,
your construction isn't all that fancy. I mean, you have a concrete floor.
Thank you.
And you have a lot of storage lockers and that kind of thing. I mean, compared to this, you're spending $300 a foot to fix it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, we're looking at all the alternatives right now. Just so you understand, one of the processes are that even though the feds will pay 75%, you've got to get in line to get the money.
Right.
Typically, if we were to start today and said we want to replace Dallas, and we go to the federal government and we say we got to have the money to do this, they'll say, fine, you compete, you're one project, get on the future year defense plan. That's a six-year plan. So at the very soonest that we could do that would be 6 years from today to get that federal money, more than likely through the standard deal. There are emergency funds available, which we're pursuing right now, and we're using this as an example. We're actually looking at the old Safeway building right across the street that is for sale, and we're looking at that as an alternative, and we're trying to get the National Guard Bureau to pony up the money so perhaps we could purchase that, which would be a whole lot better than spending this amount of money on a 1911 building. So we are definitely looking at that because we don't want to spend that kind of money on a building that frankly needs to be torn down. So we'll do everything
follow
we can.
Up to, I think exactly to my point. You're going to spend twice as much fixing old construction as you would for new construction and or purchase.
Right.
I'd hope we fully vet the idea that that building may need to be raised and you look at something different.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, I can assure you that was paramount in our thought process when this report came in, and our concerns were validated. We said we've got to look at something different. We can't spend that kind of money on this building. So that's clearly where we're at.
Thank you. Follow up.
Senator Winters.
Thank you. How long has the deferred maintenance been an issue on this building?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters.
That's your age.
All of these old structures, and if you look at what we've been able to do, Cottage Grove is a good example. It's the next oldest building. We were able to consolidate a unit out of Cottage Grove into Eugene, where we're building a new facility actually in Springfield. So we have been systematically getting away from these old buildings till we're down to one. And this is the last one. So it's been an issue. We've recognized it. It's been difficult to manage. If you look at that old picture, there was a picture in the Statesman Journal just about a month ago that showed a picture of the old Dallas Army when it was built, and it had a big parapet castle on the right side of the building. It was a gorgeous architecture, but it became on the right side, above those four windows, on the right side was this big, nice parapet, looked like a castle, which was an engineer, a symbol of the engineers, is a castle. And that had to be taken off because of the problems that it caused in leaking the roof. Couldn't keep a roof tight. So they took it off probably back in the 50s, late 60s, and got rid of that and came in with a different size, different kind of roof and a different attachment so they could keep the building dry. And so we recognize that. And it's certainly, like I told you, 7 years ago we planned on closing that. We were going to build this new building out on State Street, which we did build, and we call it the Anderson Readiness Center. We were going to close Dallas, and we were going to consolidate those units into Salem in the 17th Street Armory. As it turned out, because of the way the units were structured by the federal government, and they give you units and you have to house them, it turned out that when we got that new unit, we couldn't do that, so we had to keep the Dallas open. Does that answer your question?
Since you mentioned 17th Street, where is it in the in your...
On my chart?
Yes.
Well, let's see. It probably says Salem.
Probably down here with red going across since 02.
Yes, it would be red across right in the middle. And there, I know what the problem is. What the issue is at that armory is storage, again. Part of the problem that we had there was that we had a storage building that we had in conjunction with the state fair. You're probably familiar with that, all your knowledge of the state fair, where the old bumper car building, you probably remember that. It was kind of in dispute. No, it wasn't kind of. It was in big-time dispute. And since we had the keys and we had our stuff in there, we wouldn't move it. They wanted the building. Finally, we've come to an agreement, and we're out of that, but we are out of storage. So that undoubtedly put that into the We're using Connex's, basically, to store their equipment over at the ARC.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is one of those rookie questions, because I haven't had this kind of presentation before. How do we know what is the right number of armories, or what is the right number of facilities to have for our state? And are they in the right location? If we start thinking about needing to replace facilities, should they be rebuilt on site, somewhere else in the vicinity, or in some other region because of shifts in population or because of transportation corridors or some other factors? What are the factors, and is there a national standard that tells us
Mr. Chair,
ideal places?
Representative Nathanson, all of those are factors. Every single one of them are factors. If you look at our structure of armories throughout Oregon, most of these armories have been in these locations for 50 years or better. The only new armory that we've added in the last 20 years that I've been here, full-time anyway, I've been in the organization 37, full-time 20, was in Prineville, and that was just last session, I believe, in 2005 when we added that armory, which was an old OYA facility. And Prineville, of course, in Central Oregon, is growing robustly in population, and we wanted to impact that population base and get we were getting the recruits, we were getting the soldiers out of there. We had no place for them. They had to drive to Redmond. So we thought that was a good opportunity. The opportunity presented itself. At the same time, over the last 15 years, we've closed an armory in Tillamook. We closed an armory in Newburgh. We closed an armory in Oregon City. There was one more.
Cottage
and,
Grove.
Well, Cottage Grove we consolidated.
Silverton.
And Silverton we closed. Now, those four armories, and probably the fifth one in Cottage Grove consolidated, were primarily budget-driven. It wasn't because we wanted to close them. We knew the population base would support the units. In fact, we did a zip code study on Marion County and Silverton. What is it, 16 miles to Silverton from Salem? And it was the assumption of the policymakers at that point in time, back in 1993, that these folks would drive to Salem and stay in the Guard. I can tell you right now, I think we had a 125-man organization out there. It was a very robust organization, had been for years in that armory. I would bet you, and I haven't run it in 3 or 4 years, there's less than five people that have zips in Silverton right now. So we believe, without any question, that if you don't have a facility very close to where soldiers serve, they're not going to join, they're not going to stay. They may join, but they won't stay. So we know that for a fact. Now, back to your question of where we put them because of the need of the state. That's also a consideration. We've had requests, for instance, to put an armory in John Day. We, in order to support an armory with any kind of federal money, you have to be able to have enough soldiers there on a consistent basis. The least we can do is a detachment, which is typically around 40 people. We have an armory in Burns. I think that unit's got a grand total of 43 or 44 people are required, and we struggle to keep that armory, keep those folks, enough people in Burns. We just can't get her done. So I think it's a combination of all of what you stated. There is no perfect formula. There is no bad end. But you've got to look at population, I think, as the first driver. Second driver is it, you know, where your units naturally flow. And, for instance, Eastern Oregon is pretty much down the I-84 corridor. Makes sense, right down the corridor. Does that help explain how we go? And frankly, we don't have plans to grow additional towns and additional armories. That's not part of what we're planning. There's nowhere on our screen do we see that being a viable alternative. If anything, I would tell you that we still own the armory in Oregon City. If we were going to add anything back, we would probably look at that as maybe reactivating it and bringing it into our mix. And that would be probably the most robust thing you could do. Okay? Our military capital construction activities have 3 points of emphasis in the strategy of funding and reducing costs of facility replacement. By constructing Armed Forces Reserve Centers, as I mentioned we did in Eugene, the military department can access federal funds for approximately 90% of the total cost of the design and the construction, at the same time replace old and obsolete facilities. Assessing the federal funds requires a relatively small percentage of state matching funds. Our second emphasis is for seeking partnerships with federal, state, and other agencies to share common functions in the facility, such as entrance areas, assembly halls, parking lots, restrooms, classrooms, break areas, and food service areas. This reduces the design and construction costs and reduces the long-term operations and maintenance burden of all the agencies. And our third emphasis is working in identifying facilities and real property that are access to the agencies, this agency. The facilities and properties will be disposed of, and the funds generated from those are placed in the Oregon Military Department's Construction and Other Funds account, which draws its own interest. Aside from our military construction projects, we're seeking approval for capital construction projects and upgrading and modernizing armories not anticipated for replacement in the next two decades, and I mentioned that briefly earlier as well as one of our policy option packages. These projects will slow the further deterioration and make needed repairs and upgrades that will extend the operational life of these armories. And these improvements will also meet requirements of the Department of Defense, the National Guard Bureau, and also help us maintain the force structure that we have here. And lastly, those improvements also will help us generate more other fund revenue for rentals, which we rely very heavily on. Later on, we'll talk about capital construction. The military department's key performance measures are developed to gauge progress toward accomplishing our mission and responding to state emergencies. Emphasis for providing a rapid and effective force in responding to state emergencies rests with being able to recruit new members of the Oregon National Guard for assuring sufficient personnel levels and maintaining the armories throughout the state to assure assembly places for the force and its equipment, and providing a statewide network of facilities. Armories strategically located around the state are a vital component to our ability to appropriately respond to any emergency. During the 2005 legislature, we added seven key performance measures to monitor progress and revenue generation throughout our armory rental program, which I told you we rely on very heavily, report on progress with Oregon's at-risk youth in our youth challenge program, track our production in refurbishing military equipment, which we have a program at Camp Withicum that does that, and surveying our customers, engaging our service delivery performances. On June 30, 2006, we submitted our annual performance progress report, and we reported five of our key performance measures are making progress. The first key performance measure, titled Force Strength, measures the actual numbers of soldiers recruited compared to the annual recruiting target to assure a ready, trained force able to respond to statewide emergencies in the context of our federal mission. One of our strategies to attract and actively recruit these who want to serve, or is one of our strategies to actively recruit people who want to serve in the Oregon Guard. For the 2006 report, we measured the progress of our federal fiscal year 2005 recruiting goal. We accomplished 96% of our recruiting goal, while the national average was 80%. The previous year was 92% of target. We experienced three consecutive months of net gains to finish the year. In 2005, the Oregon legislature introduced an unprecedented number of bills supporting troops, families, and veterans. This, coupled with the enhanced federal supported initiatives, impacted these numbers significantly. Our fifth and sixth and seventh performance key performance measures on Youth Challenge Program continues to demonstrate what we have known for some time, that our program is one of the national leading programs. Later in the presentation, we'll describe more about our program, which I'm sure you've seen most of that all by now anyway, so we'll skip through that. Our eighth key performance measure monitors our production efforts in refurbishing military generators, night vision devices, and chemical detection equipment. Each year, the equipment refurbishment program is contractually awarded federal funds to receive, overhaul, and replace refurbished critical military equipment and turn that back into the national inventory. In this reporting cycle, we exceeded the annual production goal by 267 items of refurbished equipment. One of the main programs they run at Camp Withicum right now is refurbishing generators. These are generators that go out every Army unit, every military unit needs to operate out in the middle of nowhere with no electrical power. We are noted by the Department of Defense as the best site in the country. There's several of these sites. Which, that's a good news story. The bad news story is they keep sending more generators, and we don't have the capacity to employ any more people and get these things done. They want more. We can't produce it because we're running two shifts now, but that's about the best we can do. We're real proud of this program because it does a good thing for for the military, and it also had, these are family wage jobs that we were able to produce at Camp Withicum in space that was excess when we built the building. Now, of course, we're crunched for space. So we're real fond of this program. Annual performance progress report. In 2006 annual performance report, we reported two key performance measures that were not making progress. Our second key performance measure, titled Army Readiness, indicates the condition of our armies. I beat that one to death. It remains problematic, and I suspect will for some time. Our third key performance measure, titled Revenue Generation, concentrates on renting our armories when they are not in use for the primary purpose of the Oregon National Guard. Our goal is to rent our armories to generate the maximum amount of rental revenue possible. We actively market our armories and facilities in seeking partnerships with local, state, and federal agencies for long-term use agreements. Oregon State Police maintained its recruit school at Camp Rylier for many years. However, with the completion of the new Department of Public Safety and Standards and Training campus here in Salem, this arrangement has been curtailed. As far as we work at marketing our facilities for rental activity, the continued deterioration understandably diminishes their appeal, which is, again, back to that program option package. That's one of the things that I cited before. Provide good facilities, people will rent them.
Mr. Chair, question. Have your rentals gone up or down as a result of the pavilion and the changes out at the State Fair at the Armory and Center?
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, they have gone down significantly. We recognized that was probably going to happen. The good news is that they've actually started to kind of climb back up a little bit. If you looked at a graph, it plummeted, and now it's starting to come back up. And I think some of that is due to the fact that they're doing such a good job of renting that at the fair that they people want to come. There's no place to go, so they come back to us. So there is some, I think there's some additional capacity people are recognizing, and we're hoping to get back in there. In fact, we're talking to an individual right now to try to convince them that they need to do this roller derby. Seems to be real hot these days, and we're suggesting, you know, this armory would be a good place to do that. So hopefully if my vision comes true, I saw it on TV, and I told our guys, get a hold of these people, find them. You know, see if they'll rent the facility, so maybe we can turn it into a roller derby match. I don't anything to make a buck, we'll do it. Well, not anything, but close. So that would be good if we could make that happen. And that same thing is that happened at Rylea with the state police leaving. These are impacts. We recognize them. They're costly. It's going to impact us at Camp Rylea. We're trying to figure the workarounds on that right now. You won't see anything in our budget, I don't think, that represents that cut because we didn't anticipate it. We thought it would go down, but we thought the initial plan for state police was they were going to continue a certain number of weeks of school even after their DPSSD stint. They've since changed that. So it's going to be probably $250,000 cut in our revenues at Camp Rylea, which is going to impact them significantly. Under revenue generation, our goal, as I said, is to maximize this. I guess we're at annual performance report. Reported two key performance measures having unclear progress. Our fourth key performance measure, titled Revenue Generation, concentrates on increase in renting our armories by 10% each year. And we started recording the data in 2007. Our ninth key performance measure for customer service was conducted in a survey in 2006. Subsequent annual surveys will provide us the basis in determining the progress. I think 10% is probably an unreasonable amount of increase, and I don't anticipate that we're going to make that. Legislative Fiscal has met with our Fiscal Administration's Division, and proposals have been drafted to eliminate four of these key performance measures from the annual progress report. These performance measures will be maintained as internal performance measures as they were prior to the 2005 session. And we concur with that suggestion by Legislative Fiscal. Proposed changes add a key performance measure to monitoring the availability of federal military equipment for use in supporting state emergencies, which we've talked about, and we think that's a good proposal. We plan to take receipt of three key performance measures applicable to the Oregon Emergency Management from the Oregon State Police. These key performance measures relate directly to the emergency preparedness and link to the Oregon Benchmark 67. The hurricanes in the Gulf Coast made it clear that preparing for geological hazards such as earthquakes, tsunamis, and landslides in Oregon require the identification prevention activities along with establishing and maintaining effective emergency operations and recovery plans at the county level. Oregon Emergency Management maintains an inventory of local mitigation plans, monitors, updates these plans, and assesses these, making sure they meet changing FEMA requirements. Oregon Emergency Management also stays involved with the state agency partners and counties through site visits and plans and development and training exercises that they do on a quarterly basis. Recent events in the past few years have awakened us to the need for higher vigilance and preparedness for man-made and industrial disasters in addition to geological hazards. The inclusion of the Homeland Security grant functions of the Criminal Justice Service Division, increasing search and rescue activity, and evaluation and long-term recovery awareness along with dynamics of Homeland Security and emergency preparedness will require us to redefine, adjust, and continually improve upon these performance measures in conjunction with the staff at OEM. I've had the opportunity to serve as a partner and panel for members of the Oregon Chimes 3 in the policy area for public safety. The timing of this is appropriate, and assessing existing strategies and developing improved strategies to reflect on recent knowledge and experience. Now we list the key performance measures, chart 25 and 26. Our complete list of our 9 key performance measures proposed for 2007 and 2009. The budget indicates 5 major program areas, each having functional programs for delivery of services. The majority of our functional programs are operated through state plans. The Federal and National Guard Bureau are commonly referred to as cooperative agreements. These cooperative agreements are either fully funded by federal dollars or requiring some degree of state matching funds, depending on the specific program. Cooperative agreements are contractual arrangements wherein the state administers the program to include employees, resources, procurement functions, and service delivery. The state has reimbursed its costs at the agreed-upon federal participation. Administration and operation of the Oregon Emergency Management through grants provided by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security are somewhat similar to these. Tab appendix titled Prioritized List in your notebooks. I'll find it here. Here it is. We have identified and prioritized the essential budget level. With the exception of our 2 youth programs, our functional programs tie to our mission, and the prioritization is conceptually based on our purpose for administering and housing the Oregon National Guard. Note that Oregon Emergency Management resides at the essential budget level within the Oregon State Police budget, not this one. We list Homeland Security and Emergency Management as 1 in our 5 major program areas. In the next section of this presentation, the transfer of Oregon Emergency Management to the Oregon Military Department budget structure will be addressed in Policy Package 500. And Policy Package, Policy Option Package and Quality and Efficiency improvements and improvement. Over the course of this current biennium, our program and operations have continued to succeed with good results within their budgetary limitation. Quality performance. Our internal review section completed 45 reviews and audits during the fiscal year 2005 and 2006, offering valuable recommendations for improvements in federal compliance. The Oregon Military Department continues the 13-year trend of being recognized for its excellence in financial reporting by receiving the annual Gold Star Award from the Department of Administrative Services State Controllers Division. Secretary of State's Audit Division conducted 5 financial and federal compliance audits over the last 2 biennia without identifying any material findings. And our Youth Challenge program has received 8 federal audits over the past 5 years. Oregon Youth Challenge has been recognized as the best overall challenge program nationally for 2 of those 5 years and the best challenge program for post-residential mentorship in 2005. For fiscal year 2006, OYCP was recognized as the most progressive nationally by maintaining the highest graduation rate among all youth challenge programs. Employees, the chart demonstrates the effectiveness we have made in leveraging the most from the federal participation as it relates to our state and federal staff. As I explained earlier, you can do the math back to 101, 102, and where we're at today. For the past 7 biennia, we have been successful in leveraging more federal participation out of necessity and mixed funding, and we've increased that. And our trend of reducing fully funded positions with the general fund seems to be at its low ebb, we hope, and we would like to see that improve as time goes on. Under efficiencies,
just a moment, please. Senator Brown.
Just a question, again, my inexperience here. Affirmative action, does it apply to this agency and the state affirmative action statutes? Does it apply to this agency?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, we consider them that they do. Whether or not anybody here wants to make that call, we certainly comply with those. And we, I thought we had them in our budget as part of our standard package. We do. Okay. Yeah, we're back here.
Great.
It would be a special report and a larger binder.
Great.
So I certainly invite you to review that. We can pull it out and make a slide for it and have some testimony on it. But
that's okay. I'll take a look at it.
Okay. We also, when you look at the 8,500, we look at this thing both separately and combined. We look at it separately in the 8,500 guardsmen. We have 2,100 full-time employees, so you have actually a separate set of standards that we look at. But we try to look at the whole thing because we have to meet. We are committed to meeting those standards.
Thank you.
Please refer to the tab in your notebook titled List of Efficiencies for the confirmation of the areas we have had success in with savings and efficiencies. Examples of success and quality performance I've mentioned to this point is leadership and culturally based within our organization. Within our organizational culture, individuals and program accomplishments can be attributed to the value and the loyalty and dedication, respect, self-service, honor, integrity, and professional courage. And we believe our people emulate that, and we ask them to emulate that in everything they do and every action they take. We have 22 policy packages in the governor's recommended budget for continuous improvement in the service delivery of our program areas. These policy packages are either directly tied to key performance measures or impact effectiveness in our meeting the mission. I will be completely candid with you that I know that people have been commented by the different bureaucracies throughout the state government that we have an exceptional number of policy packages. I will tell you from our standpoint, our philosophy is real simple. We believe it's our responsibility to let you know everything that we can possibly let you know. And you choose to deal with those how you may, but we certainly don't think it's fair for us to hide the ball either. So it may seem like a lot, but it could be more. We've actually trimmed them. In the occupational health and safety program, in response to dramatically increased workers' compensation and risk management expenses and fees for the next biennium, the Oregon Military Department added duties to an existing position to assist the agency in its efforts to enhance our occupational health and safety awareness. Human Resources Division, Department of Administrative Services reviewed the duties and classified the work as a safety specialist too. The existing classification of the position was a human resources analyst too. The enhanced occupational health and safety awareness work began with this employee being compensated through a work-out-of-class arrangement and is pending approval of the policy package. The upper reclassification amounts to $5,558 increase and other funds limitation for the biennium. Other funds pay for this through the National Guard Bureau approved centralized personnel plan where we allocate the costs across all programs supported by federal funds. Enhanced efforts and awareness in occupational health and safety should keep the rising costs in check. We will assess reporting data annually as to the number of severity and events and analyze these impacts over the enhanced awareness of our efforts. Certainly recognize that safe costs are getting extremely high, and we're trying everything we can do to try to limit those incidences. Limited duration and permanent positions. Prior to the implementation of the Oregon Budget Information Tracking System for budget development and monitoring leading in 2005, the agency got by with one budget analyst position. The workload increased associated with the orbits, and more programs were added, and existing programs grew larger and more complex. To ensure critical deadline and accuracy were met with the increased workload and complexities, the agency brought on a limited duration part-time fiscal analyst to assist us. Funded this through the centralized personnel plan and exhausted other fund expenditure limitations. Experience has made us aware that one fiscal analyst working full-time could not be expected to consistently maintain accuracy and deadlines in the workload without having to work continuous long hours and weekends. discovered that the additional fiscal analyst working part-time does enable the agency to meet critical deadlines. This policy package seeks to establish the current limited duration position as a permanent part-time and ask for approval of 98,000 other funds limitations. Op 107, our National Guard reintegration program was established in the 2003-2005 biennium, mainly in response to the critical need arising from the American citizen soldiers and airmen returning from long-term war zone deployments. These returning soldiers and airmen require assistance reintegrating back into civilian life, whether it be pay issues, finding jobs, applying for veterans assistance, or even emotional support during the transition back to civilian lives. This is a valuable program, and it's a 24/7 operational program, and it provides a central clearinghouse to our National Guard members, pointing them towards all available avenues for assistance. This team is viewed as more approachable than governmental agencies, and many times soldiers will not respond to other governmental people like police officers, chaplains, this sort of thing, but they will respond to one of their fellow soldiers who has been in the same situations they've been in. I could give you several different anecdotal stories about people that have experienced PTSD and what our people have done in the middle of the night to get out and interdict on these situations and prevent further harm to themselves or other family members, and we've had numerous ones.
General,
I've been concerned about that issue, and I was wondering if you have any idea, like compared to the regular Army or the Marines, who are the active duty people who are kind of more geared, and here we're taking people, you know, that are working at the, whatever they're working at here, a factory or something, and then we're throwing them into really into some horrible situations, and are we having a much, do we see a higher experience of this, and are we, do we have some adequate people, adequate programs for these people coming back?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, one of the big challenges that we recognized, well, frankly, I'll be real candid with you, we did not recognize this initially. We had our first unit that deployed in right at the beginning of the war. We had two units that were sent out. They were gone for the best part of 18 months. They came home. We had a ceremony and said, glad you're home. We'll see you in a couple months for drill, because the National Guard Bureau said that we were to leave them alone for 60 days, and they wouldn't pay for them to come in and be talked to, work with, or anything for that 60 days. We got some very directed and interesting feedback from family members and soldiers about how we were inadequate. Thank God it was only a small group of people, relative speaking. When the 2nd Battalion, 162nd Infantry, was deployed and ended up in Sadr City in Baghdad, at a total, I think, of 12 casualties, people were killed. We recognized then that we had a serious issue that was facing us. We had 650 people who had been through hell and back, and they were going to come back into the United States. You have 7 to 10 days at Fort Lewis, and then be turned loose 3 days later in the Mid-Willamette Valley, primarily the state of Oregon. After the feedback we'd received from the previous element, we started putting together this reintegration team. There was no federal funding for it. There was no authorization. There was no program. We developed it. And we said, we don't know what we're doing here, because we've never dealt very closely with the Veterans Administration. It's always been after people retire, they go to the VA. We didn't deal with it. We said, you know, go find somebody in the VA. So we had a lot of learning to do, and we had to do it very quickly. We put together our first summit just prior to the 2162 coming home. That summit involved, and we frankly weren't even sure who to ask. We went to the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. We invited every veterans group that we could think of, and we basically put out a press release that said, if you think you have something to do with returning guardsmen, we'd like you to come to this meeting. We had county representatives, city representatives, law enforcement representatives, because we theorized that probably we're going to find these people in the blotter at the county level when they get arrested for having a problem. And the bulk of that was going to be in the good city of Eugene, where their headquarters is. So by doing that, we were able to outreach to different people, and we were able to learn on our own what we needed to do to provide these people with resources. We recognized shortly after that, based on some of the partners that we had from the Department of Human Services and all the other state agencies who leaned forward very, very dramatically, that not only would we hopefully be able to direct these soldiers and their families to the right place for care once they returned, but we would probably prevent the county system, which we recognize as being fairly fragile, of being overloaded either in the jail system or the mental health system. And we were told very directly about that. Having been a former county commissioner, I can tell you I know how fragile that is. And I thought this would be insurmountable to suddenly have 200 or 300 people standing on the doorstep of Lane County saying, I need mental health care. So by doing that, we were able to bring these people in, give them a briefing. More importantly, we were able to give their families, their wives, their mothers, their children, everybody else's families, on one, what to expect, because there is some information out there on that. And two, where to seek help. I don't know if we brought those magnets or passed them out or not, did we?
It's on your back.
In your notebook, you'll find a magnet, refrigerator magnet in the last pocket. We pass these out to everybody, every single family member, anybody that may have an interest in a soldier. On that was a 24/7 number where somebody could call and get somebody, because what we've also learned with experience after this first group came back is a lot of times they will not talk to and say, hey, I'm from the police department, and you know this, being a former policeman, that, you know, and they say, well, you're not a veteran. You don't know what I went through. And we've had, by able to do that, we've been able to actually call team members and have them go to that particular site and talk people off the ledge, if you will. Now, back to your question, and I rambled on here, and I apologize, but the question, 30%, the national average is active duty, primarily these numbers come from active duty, 30% of the people who have left the combat zone experience some form of post-traumatic stress disorder. That's the national average. We have not kept records on this, and mainly because soldiers have a tendency not to want to tell their bosses and their units that I'm having trouble. The VA does keep a record, and I think we're right in, and of course they mix it. They don't say, well, this guy's guard, this guy's reserve, this guy's active duty. So I think we're right in that from, you know, what we hear, we're right in that zone, probably 30% of these folks. Some of them are more pronounced than others, and some of them don't manifest themselves until a year and a half later, which we've started to see, which has been surprising, I guess, but then again, it shouldn't be. So to answer your question, sir, I think that we're pretty much average. I don't think we're above or below it. I will tell you that this program, we were... The Guard Bureau finally woke up and said last fall, they said, we're getting a lot of reports that there's problems in different states with returning guardsmen. And, yeah, you know, hello. And so they invited all the states into a meeting. They said, if you're doing a program, please come back and tell us what you're doing. We're going to have a forum. We sent our team back. They were the third presenter. And after they finished their program, what we do here in Oregon, and showed them that we've diverted some federal resourcing that we had, limited, very little. We took it away from some other area that was programmed for. We came to this legislative body and got state money to robust it to make it what it is. We presented that. The Guard Bureau chief that was there got up and said, all right, don't seem to see anything else. Everybody copy Oregon. They got it figured out. They're doing it right. You copy them, and that's what every state should have, something that's very close to that, which is a good news story. And we're continuing to make these things known to the National Guard Bureau that we've got to receive more federal funding for this. In my judgment, it's a good cost avoidance for the state, but it certainly is not the state's responsibility. In my judgment, it's 100% federal responsibility. But we can argue that point, but that doesn't get the job done. And so we thank this legislative body for providing those resources and allowing us to continue on, because at the end of the day, I think we're going to have a better soldier at the end of the day after their deployments.
Thank you.
Do you want to follow up?
I think that pretty much answers. I just would say very briefly, I mean, on a much smaller scale and different problem with the police shootings, we have changed programs so somebody gets instant help and they're helped with somebody who's been through shooting and so on, and have been very successful in getting them psychiatric treatment, requiring that so that it isn't once you made everybody go. Before, you could go and nobody would go, and once everybody went, and where originally when I was a young officer, somebody who'd been involved in a shooting within 5 years would be gone, and now they can salvage them really early on and So I really appreciate the efforts you've made here in Oregon to do that, and that's all. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that we've been hearing with all of the other public safety budgets is that it seems that the public safety agencies have a disproportionate share of folks going into the National Guard and military, so they're going to come back into very stressful jobs as corrections officers, police officers, OIA corrections officers as well. And I think it'll be doubly challenging. I mean, to be in a corrections officer, always being in, you know, constant state of readiness, I think that'll be particularly difficult. Senator Brown.
Thank you. Just a quickie. My sense of your description is that these folks are connectors. They're connecting the folks that need it to services.
Right.
Can you give us comfort that this is adequate in order to meet the need in Oregon at this point in time, or at least over the next couple of years?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, right now, yes, I think that we're accomplishing what we set out to do, which is to get the referrals, get the soldier who and the family who knows that they can pick up the phone and they can call it 24/7, and somebody's going to answer it. They're going to tell them they're having a problem, and we've got a good enough team now, knowledgeable enough team, that when that phone call is referred, they know who to call based on where the area is. Now, I'll tell you, the summits that we've been having, I think we've had five of them now. We've got one coming up in April, and you're all welcome over here at the Salem Armed Forces Reserve Center on State Street. It's been an amazing thing to me to watch all of the different groups that have come together. And these are folks that genuinely understand the need, and they're willing to offer of their time and their expertise to help us connect those dots. And that's been the best thing that's come out of this, bar none. And we've got a very good network now of how to do that. The other success story on this reintegration process is that we have a career transition process as well. I can tell you right now, we've interviewed hundreds of soldiers that have come through the standard we'll have briefings. And I will guarantee you, in 30 days, probably 80% of those, they'll ask a question, and you'll say, well, now, wait a minute, you got that briefing when you were at Fort Lewis, or you got it when you deprocessed in Salem. They never heard it. They didn't know. They have not heard it. They said, well, I don't remember that. And so we've had to re-engineer our process, and we have cut down that piece, and we said, we're going to give it to you. You're going to have it. Your families are going to have it. You're going to have the packet. But we're going to revisit you in 60 days. And we're taking it now on the road. We go to the unit. We set up at the unit, and we sit there and say, all right, here we are again, guys, and we're going to give the same thing again. And it's amazing. These people say, really, again? That's news to me. I didn't know that. And so we know that we've got to continue to keep forcing this information down so they'll get it. But I'm real comfortable with what we're doing right now. I think we've got a good program going, and I think that we're meeting the need. And, again, I invite you to this summit because I think that would be interesting for you to watch.
General Caldwell, I'll be sending out information to my constituents informing them about the event on Tuesday. And to remind all of you, on Tuesday at 3 o'clock, we're going to do some in-depth informational hearing on reintegration as well as mental health and post-traumatic stress disorder. And I was going to send out something by the web to my constituents. If this website, does that also include a lot of this information
that
you're talking about?
It does.
Okay.
And I think we'll have the reintegration team in here on Tuesday as well. I think they're up Tuesday. So you'll have a chance to talk to the people that are actually doing the work. Program Option Package 108 is hunting and fishing licenses. During the last session, the Oregon legislature authorized $350,000 for this purpose. We reimburse soldiers. The soldier purchases this. It can be our soldier or a reservist or an active duty person. And then they submit a form to us, or basically a copy of the license that they purchased, and we reimburse the individual. The current cost of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife hunting and angling license is $43.75. We estimate that $60,000 is going to be adequate for this for the next 2 years. I think we overestimated it last time, didn't know what to expect, so we've revised that number. We had that discussion today in Representative Barker's committee as well. In Program Option Package 110, Homeland Security Policy Advisor,
With the merger that is before you as well in House Bill 2370, where emergency management is moved to the military department, we believe this position is act as a liaison between us, the governor's office, and the legislature, and state and local agencies for homeland security matters and emergency operations. This would help determine the policy, program priorities, optimal utilization of the resources, and be directly working for the adjutant or working with the adjutant general. Requesting $189,022 general funds to establish this principal executive G position. And FOP 202, Salem Flight Operations Facility. This is for funds for the operations of the facility, maintenance, and repair, support the Salem Flight Operations Facility. This facility is supported 75% federal funds and 25% state funds. FOP 203 is Central Oregon.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. General, what's the construction schedule piece on there? We had originally projected that we would be able to start construction on that about, 3 months ago, 4 months ago? And that was delayed for two reasons. One was the site. We had to shift the site. We purchased a site from the neighbor. The site had cleanup issues on it. They were not progressing as quickly as we had hoped they would. Through the DEQ, they granted some issues that they didn't think were there, and they were there. So suddenly we had to shift the site. Secondly, we had made it a contract arrangement for a design build with a firm who expressed early indications that they were not going to be very cooperative in a design build process. How familiar you are with that process, but in design build, that's basically a contractor and a architect working together to come up to meet a certain criteria. The contractor and the architect were basically treating it as a design bid build, and every time we had a discussion with them, they said, well, that's going to be extra money, and we said, no, you've agreed to do it for this amount of money, and it became almost unworkable, so we cut our losses before we ended up in a lawsuit and had to put it back out on the street to select another person. So those two reasons delayed the building.
Paul, is this the replacement of the mobile building that sat there?
The double wide. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, as much as we hate to get rid of that double wide, yes, it will replace that. The temporary double wide that went in there 20 years ago? Yeah.
Thank you.
Prop 203 is Central Oregon Readiness Center. $37,293 general fund is requested for basic facility operations and maintenance and repair for the Central Oregon Readiness Center in Prineville. This would be adequate funding to operate and maintain, support the facility that we use now in the city of Prineville for 52 soldiers that are stationed there. 206, operations program positions. This policy package seeks approval for $159,039 other funds and $258,936 federal funds for expenditure limitations for five maintenance positions. 16 were originally requested in the agency request budget, and five were recommended by the governor. Of the five positions, two are federally funded facilities maintenance specialists, one at Camp Riley and one in Salem. One is a federally funded custodian in Salem, and two are other funded custodial service coordinators who will coordinate custodial work at Camp Withicum, Tigard, Hillsboro, and several of the Portland area's armories. Approval of this package will enhance the agency's ability to adequately maintain our facilities. In POP 207, this policy package seeks establishment of three permanent positions currently performing limited duration throughout the current biennium. Two are construction project managers, and one is a procurement and contract specialist. All three positions are 100% federally funded and work on our installations division. Approval of these packages will allow our construction projects to be completed with a proper oversight. Mr. Chair. You have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. General Caldwell, the construction project managers are specific to the Flight Operations Center project or to other deferred maintenance projects?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, it depends, yes. Whenever we build a new project, we dedicate a
person to that project. Secondly, we have minor construction projects that go on constantly, like you saw the list for the Dallas Armory, for instance. So whenever we have a project like that, we have project managers who also execute those contracts, but they're considerably smaller. And so they're usually used in small numbers as opposed to the big operations like you see at Salem.
Follow up? How many folks are in those type of positions currently?
I'll have to get back to you with that. I don't know. Several, but I'll get you that answer.
That's great.
Yeah, that's important.
And Chair Shields and Representative Gannon, if I may also add, the department is proposing an aggressive capital construction schedule. So these positions would be associated with some other policy option packages that the agency will brief on a little bit later.
Yes, thank you. General, can we go back to the facilities operation positions? The two custodial service coordinators, are those positions, and then one custodian, is a custodian somebody who would be, you know, just like a janitor that takes care of the facilities? Is the reason that we don't go outside and bid those things out to private facilities, is it because of security reasons?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, there is a security issue involved in every facility. That's one of our concerns. I think custodial is probably the misnomer in the terms. We call them actually Army operating technicians because they have to be far more capable than just pushing a broom. Now, I would obviously it's not impossible to go out and find some of those functions. For instance, we have prison labor do some of our custodial work here in Salem where we can get them, and we have people that can watch them. But generally speaking, like I told you earlier, if people want their area cleaned up, they clean it. These people actually do maintenance. They fix things. They do other activities other than just empty the garbage and clean the floor.
Thank you. All right, we've got a couple more minutes.
Well, then let's do, where are we at, 208?
Want to do one more?
Yeah, let's do one more. This policy package rectifies 20 positions in the operations program that have been classified incorrectly. They span a variety of occupations such as accounting technicians, carpenters, program analysts, operation managers, and force protection officers at Kingsley Field Air National Guard Base. These positions were reviewed by the Human Resources Service Division, Department of Administrative Service, which determined they would be at higher classifications. The employees are currently being paid work out of class at the higher classification pending approval. This package requests $6,277 in other funds and $168,509 in federal funds. One more?
No, why don't...
Let me take a question.
Yeah, question, and then we'll wrap up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
In the DAS review of the classifications,
yes, sir.
Are there any downward classifications?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, not to my knowledge. and I want to sound cute, or I just tell you my perception on this. We did not do a very good job throughout the 90s of reviewing our positions. And, you know, a lot of that's attributed to the fact that we didn't have a lot of staff to do it. And what's occurred, and frankly, we started seeing a trend that was rather disturbing, was that I said, well, you know, we're a farm club for every other agency in the state. I started seeing all these people that were good and solid, and they get in, they work a couple years with us, they're really getting the job done, and all of a sudden they're leaving and going to other agencies. So I said, why is this? Why would they leave here if they're going to do a similar job or the same job at another agency? And the answer came back exclusively that they're getting paid more money. I said, okay, why in the hell are they getting more money there and they're not getting it here? That doesn't make any sense. And so we looked in the mirror and it was us. So we didn't do as good a job as we should have been doing during that period of time to get that done. So we did start out about 3 or 4 years ago of really starting to go through these positions and review them and see where we were at and going to DAS and saying, this is what they're doing, where are they at? So, but to answer your question, no, I don't know of any that have
That's
gone
fair.
Down. And but there, if there are some, I'll go back and ask because there may be one.
Okay.
Mr. Borden has a comment he'd like to make.
Chair Shields and Representative Hatt, I believe out of the 34 or so reclasses that the department is proposing, there are several downward reclasses, but those are at the department's initiative as opposed to coming out of the review process by DAS. So the department is has selected two positions that it is downward reclassing to use those funds essentially to finance other portions of the upward reclasses.
Great, thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Don't forget the event Tuesday, 3 o'clock. Very important that you're all there participating because it's a critical issue for all of our constituents in the country. Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.